content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times and National Geographic Traveler. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Christmas is often associated with places when we ponder those special holiday memories. In her article, Dreaming of an Artisanal Christmas, Southern California native Ann Ma tells of her search for an old-fashioned Christmas. She found it in the Christmas ornament town of Zeifen, tucked into Germany's Ruhr Mountains. Her story appeared in the December 18, 2019 issue of the New York Times. For as long as I can remember, I've had this image of Christmas, a village nestled in a snowy valley, candlelit windows glowing against a night sky. I'm not sure where it came from. Growing up in sunny California, my family strung lights on the palm trees in our yard and went to the beach on Christmas Eve. Most kids know about Santa's sleigh, but I believe he traveled on a magic speedboat. As an adult, I've searched for that old-fashioned Christmas, one of snow-tipped Yuletide cheer, sleigh rides, sugar plums, and freshly cut pine trees trimmed with handcrafted ornaments. Though I visited the Christmas markets in European capitals like London, Paris, and Vienna, I never really found it. Yes, the fairy lights twinkled, the sweet scent of mulled wine drifted, and sometimes snow crunched under my heels. Yes, the market stalls displayed an array of glittering ornaments for the tree and home. Yet upon closer inspection, the decorations were flimsy, their designs repeating from vendor to vendor as if they shared the same supplier, an industrial factory in a distant land. Was my vision of Christmas a relic of fairy tales, or could it still exist in a country that celebrates the Christmas tree with a traditional folk song, Old Tannenbaum? When I recently reconnected with a high school friend who had moved to Germany, I asked her about German Christmas markets, expecting her to extol the storybook wonders of Nuremberg or Dresden. Instead, she described a place I'd never heard of, the Christmas ornament town of Zeifen in Erzgebirge, or Ruhr Mountains, a rural part of Saxony, so devoted to holiday decor that Germans call it the home of Christmas. Could this be the artisanal Christmas idyll I'd been dreaming of? To find out, I spent a few days in mid-October in this far eastern region of the former German Democratic Republic near the Czech border, immersing myself in Erzgebirge's traditional folk art. Today, the region is famous among collectors around the world for its handcrafted wooden Christmas ornaments, including nutcrackers, pyramids that spin in the heat of candles, and smoking men, wooden incense holders carved as miners and other figurines. Many Erzgebirge Christmas decorations honor the region's mining history. Mining is so important here that in July, UNESCO named the region a World Heritage Site in recognition of its mining activity from the 12th to 20th centuries. As mining production began to wane in the 17th century, residents turned to woodworking and toy making. My trip began with a 50-mile drive from Dresden's airport to the town of Zeifen, which was easier than you'd think for a road that winds through a mountain range, albeit a low one, twisting gently to reveal slopes and green valleys dotted with farms. At the Zeifen town limits, a sign proclaimed Spitzelsudorf, or Toy Village, and I noted nutcrackers adorning the gaslit street lamps. After dropping off my bags at Bontes House, a spotless family-run hotel in the center of town, I headed out to explore by foot. I knew I was too early for Zeifen's renowned Christmas market, which is held annually during the Advent season, the period that includes the four Sundays preceding Christmas. And I feared I was too early for Christmas at all. And then I ran into two competing food stands, one on each side of the street. the type of rough timber huts I associate with outdoor markets. Though it was a beautiful fall day, sunny and mild, a few families and couples had gathered at each stand, eating grilled bratwurst and sipping mugs of Glühwein or mulled wine. Clearly, I had come to the right place. Indeed, as I perused the workshops and galleries lining the Hofstrasse, or main street, I found every single one bursting with hand-carved, brightly painted Christmas decorations. They ranged from thimble-sized angels to spinning pyramids as tall as I am to nutcrackers, Santas, woodsmen, and more. Individually, each figure was exquisite. The fine details and droll expressions clearly the work of expert artisans. Collectively, however, they became overwhelming. The colors, tiny limbs, and faces turning to a blur of color. Happily for my untrained eye, I found a guide in Suzanne Blaschk, the online manager of Wendt & Kuhn, a family-owned producer of Erzgebirger figurines. Founded in 1915 by two women, Greta Wendt and Marguerite Kuhn, they were unusual for the time, Miss Blaschk said. Today the company is in its third generation of Wendt family owners. Production takes place in the nearby village of Grünheckenkreis. But the boutique in Zeifen sells a bevy of hand-painted wooden collectibles. Rosy-cheeked blossom children are Blumenkinder, toting oversized flowers, Kirschgepet peasants gathering berries, and then dainty angels, their green wings adorned with 11 trademark dots of white and more. Inspired by local flora and suffused with old-world charm, almost all the designs were created by the founders, or Ole, as Ms. Blaschke refers to Ole Wendt, who married Greta's brother, Johannes, in 1929. Each figure takes about 6 weeks to create, and a 5-person team is dedicated to painting only the faces to ensure consistency. The whimsical creations have a devoted international fan base and are exported to more than 25 countries. Before I left the shop, Ms. Blaschke described some of the other crafts traditionally produced in Erzgebirge. Candle arches, nutcrackers, and the Christmas pyramids, those small, delicate, tiered wooden carousels that are lit with candles and topped with a propeller that turns in the heat of the flames. But when she tried to describe the small wooden animals and figures called ring-turned toys in German, Rietfintje, we both conceded linguistic defeat. The next morning, after having breakfast amid nutcrackers, and candle arches in my hotel's dining room, I headed to the Freilich Museum, or open-air museum, to learn about a ring-turned toy as well as the history of the Ore Mountain region. On the outskirts of Zeifen, tucked into a stream-fed valley, the Folklore Museum is a collection of mostly 18th and 19th century buildings gathered to form a traditional Erzgebirger village. A cold rain fell during my self-guided visit, but as I dashed from house to house, I told myself the damp weather and gust of wind conjured up a Christmassy mood. I thrust my icy hands into my coat pockets and tried not to gaze too longingly at the unlit tiled oven stoves that had once served as a home's sole source of warmth. Through the dusty windows, I peered into a half-timbered 18th-century miner's house. The cramped, primitive conditions, the living room next to a goat stable, for example, illustrating the region's historic poverty. In the 15th century, the Erzgebirger was the most important source of silver in Europe. But mining wages were so meager, many workers supplemented their incomes with farming or woodworking. As the veins began to dry up in the 18th century, the local economy started to rely heavily on side gigs like woodworking, which evolved into toy making. The toasty scent of sawdust greeted me at the Ring Turner's Wood Shop, which was built in 1758. Inside, a veteran craftsman in a striped blue shirt and jeans worked with the yellow glow of a spotlight. Ring-turned toys are named after their production method, and not to be confused with wind-up toys that move by twisting an attached ring or winding key. The ring, the word in quotes, is actually a circle of wood that is turned or carved on the lathe to create a grooved wheel. This carved ring is then sliced with a knife sideways like a loaf of bread, so that the cross section forms the crude outline of a figure which is refined, carved, and painted. Each ring produces a different creature, an elephant, rabbit, or bear. Ring-turned toys were invented in Ziphon around 1800. It was a special technique to cheaply produce wooden animals, said Conrad Auerbach, the director of the Eskeberger Toy Museum in Ziphon. We were standing in the museum's main gallery, surrounded by displays of antique ring-turned animals. Ziphon became one of the continent's leading toy producers, fueled in part by the Eskeberger's relative proximity to Nuremberg, then the center of the European toy trade, Dr. Auerbach said. The region's tradition of making highly detailed and handcrafted Christmas ornaments also began here in the 1800s, Dr. Auerbach continued as we gazed at an enormous 19th century Christmas pyramid. Not for production, not for selling, but just made for the home, for the family, he said. Toy makers created holiday decorations that reflected the Eskeberger's mining history. The candle arch, for example, resembles the entrance to a mine, like the Christmas pyramid. It features a blaze of candles symbolizing the mine workers' constant desire for light. During the Advent season, towns without the Eskeberger, or rather throughout the Eskeberger, still host miners' parades, the marching ranks dressed in traditional uniforms that resemble 19th century military garb. Upstairs, the museum traced the gradual decline of the local toy industry's golden era, from the advent of metal toys in the early 20th century to the rise of holiday decorations under the communist German Democratic Republic of 1949 to 1990, when the state directed toy makers to focus prominently on Christmas to satisfy popular export demand. Today, only six producers of ring-turned toys remain. Now it's mostly decorative, Dr. Auerbach said. Toys for the parents, less for the children. He had a point. By this time, I had seen enough Ziphon ornaments to know they were meant to be admired, not grabbed by small fingers. Still, during my midweek visit, I also noticed how warmly the town welcomed families. Several workshops offer activities for kids, like creating an Advent wreath or painting a toy train. Shops like the Handwerksmarkt sell craft supplies to make your own Christmas pyramid or carve and paint a set of ring-turned animals. And I spotted many families of German tourists. They appear to be mostly grandparents and grandchildren exploring the toy village together. A few miles outside of Ziphon, I thought I was still in Germany, but my cell phone had just welcomed me to the Czech Republic. I stood outside a plain, steeple-roofed house looking at a small sign that read, Fjuchner, and featured a nutcracker. It was the only clue I was in the right place. I was here because of an offhand comment from Dr. Auerbach, the toy museum director. The nutcracker, he said, was invented in Ziphon by Wilhelm Fuchner. The nutcracker, I asked, the star of Tchaikovsky's Christmas ballet? Yes, he said. The family still produces them for export. He couldn't offer an address or any other information, but when I asked at my hotel, the woman at the front desk suggested I head south of town, out on the Deichendorfstrasse, a two-lane road. When I saw the sign, I pulled over. A young woman answered my knock at the door. I didn't have an appointment, and I don't speak German, but her face broke into a smile as soon as I uttered the words Nutcracker and Dr. Auerbach. She ushered me into a bright workshop where half-painted nutcracker body parts were lined up with military precision. Her name is Carola Seifert, or Seifert, rather, and she is one of five people employed at the family-owned Fuchner workshop. Created by Wilhelm Fuchner in the 1870s, the Christmas Nutcracker, as we know it, that upright, clenched-toothed toy soldier, might have been inspired by Ernst Hoffmann's story, Miss Seifert said, referring to the Nutcracker and the Mouse King, which was published in 1816. But it was also a form of satire. Generally depicting an authority figure like a soldier, policeman, or king, the Nutcracker represented power, while the nut, cracked in its powerful jaws, symbolized the people. It was a political joke, she said. Fichtner's nutcrackers, carved from lindenwood, their hair and beards created from scraps of rabbit fur, started about 50 euros or about 56 U.S. dollars. And the workshop also produces smoking men, or Rockenmanner, incense holders, carved in the shape of little men who puff smoke through their mouths. I found one such bearded chap in Green Irresistible. He's called the Ghost of the Woods, Miss Seifert said. I bought him for 30 euros. In fact, I found a lot of irresistible creations in Zeifen. I could have spent many hours at the workshops of Volk Kuntz and Richard Glasser, where the public is invited for free at the former, with a modest fee of 2 euros at the latter, to observe the artisans as they glue small figures onto Christmas pyramids, for example, or meticulously paint nutcracker belts. And I could have spent many euros at the local galleries, especially Drigeno, the town's cooperative of Etzgebirge Arts and Crafts, which sells the work of more than 120 artisans. On my last morning in Zeifen, I walked up a hill to visit the Berkeskirche, or Christmas or Mountain Church, built in 1776, the octagonal steepled butter-yellow structure is often depicted in Erzgebirge folk art. Inside, the late Baroque architecture created a sense of airiness. I half listened to a German tour guide while I pictured the space at Christmas, ablaze with light and organ music. Lost in my thoughts, I left the church and promptly took a wrong turn, heading away from town. When I turned, I saw pitched-roof houses nestled in the valley, and with a blink imagined them covered with snow, candles shining from almost every window, glowing against the winter night. It was just like the Christmas village of my dreams. Wow. Well, most of us can probably think of at least one magical place where we've been in our travels. For writer and senior editor Amy Alipio, it was A Child's Summer in Wales, published in the October-November 2019 issue of National Geographic Traveler. She tells how a season of magical landscapes and unpronounceable words inspired a life in travel. So let us see where she takes us, okay? In a few weeks, I'll be traveling to Wales to attend the 100th birthday celebration of my uncle, who lives in a village on the Gower Peninsula overlooking a wide sandy bay. The first time I visited him and my aunt there, I was 14. That summer, I developed a serious crush on Wales. The place appealed to a bookish introvert like me. I was deep in my King Arthur phase, to be replaced by my current Harry Potter phase, and the legendary ruler had connections throughout Wales. There was the Caerleon, the supposed site of Camelot, Merlin said to have come from the town of Carmarthen. One day, my aunt and uncle took me and my younger brother pony trekking on the Kevin Bren Common, a windy heath of bracken and gorse flanking the sandstone backbone of Gower. There we came across Arthur's Stone, said to have grown from a pebble tossed out of the king's shoe. Wales' biggest national gathering is the annual Eisteddfod, a festival of poetry and music. Basic, or bardic tradition, rather, is a point of official pride. Literary celebrity Dylan Thomas was born in Swansea, the gateway city for Gower. He called it an ugly, lovely town. My uncle introduced me to the Welsh alphabet with its unusual characters such as LL, which appears in everyday nouns like than, or church, and names like Thuellen. A Welshman later told me the sound is pronounced like the engine of your car starting. There you go. You get the idea, I hope. That summer was the first time this suburban girl began to think about words to describe the natural world. Wales is a landscape of imagination, writ with magic and chivalry, from the Gower Peninsula's Worm's Head, a serpentine headline that is perfectly, headland rather, that is the perfect spot for a sunset stroll, to misty Talathin Lake in Snowdonia National Park in the north. This scenery is to stock a dictionary with. Each new word I unearth, which was like cairn and tor and coon, marshmallow, oyster catcher, led to more words, brin, coon, differin, until it was a landslide of language. Name it, and the world seemed brighter, more knowable, but at the same time profoundly mysterious. The fact that my uncle was as bookish as I was cemented my attachment to a country that celebrates poets. Although he was of English heritage, he had grown up in Wales. He and my Filipina aunt, my father's sister, still live in this book-filled family home. Many afternoons we'd sit reading in their small glass-enclosed porch overlooking the garden. Usually the proper British gentleman, soft-spoken and witty, he'd let out some mild expletive while commenting about some national politician. He wasn't the type to reminisce about his years serving in the Royal Air Force during World War II, but he would talk about playing the organ at Cambridge or why he didn't buy tickets for an all-tuba concert at the Gower Chamber Music Festival he and my aunt patronize every year. I couldn't visualize that. It was a whole evening, wasn't it, of tuba? In 2016, his most recent book, A History of Maritime Trade in Australia, was published. I've returned to Wales several times since that summer, but I haven't gone as often as I'd like. On my most recent visit, I came across a heart-shaped piece of inky black Welsh slate in a gift shop with the word Hiereth painted on it. I asked what it meant, and I was told it didn't translate to one equivalent word in English. Hiereth conveys nostalgia, yearning for something lost, homesickness, but not merely an ache for the four walls of home, but for something bigger, a land longing, a people longing. I ended up buying the souvenir. It spoke to the way I feel about Wales and family when I'm not here, and I like the idea of a word so overflowing with meaning that it takes a bunch of other words to begin to understand it. Ever since that first Welsh summer of legends and beauty, words and travel have been inseparable for me. In both leisure and work, including 18 years at this magazine, I am forever in search of precisely the right words to illuminate places. I learned back then that these words, strung together to create true stories, can forge rock-hard bonds of soulful connection. So here's to wheeling 100 times around the sun, Uncle Howard. I thank you for giving me Wales and all the other wondering words that have followed, words especially such as heareth, remembrance, longing, love, gratitude. By the way, Amy says she's yet to meet an afternoon tea in Britain she didn't like. Oh, my goodness. Some great travel stuff there, huh? Well, we move on. Have you ever heard the phrase forest bathing? Well, it is a thing, which writer Kelly DiNardo is going to explain in Obsessions, the column found in the December 2019, January 2020 issue of National Geographic Traveler. And as she begins her article, A Walk in the Woods, she tells us the Japanese practice of forest bathing uses trees to calm, boost creativity, and reconnect with nature. And here we go. I rub the pine needles between my thumb and forefinger. Really get in there, Josh Heath says, grabbing a fistful of needles, crushing them between his bear-like palms, and inhaling deeply. I follow his lead and roll the prickly red spruce needles between my hands, bring my palms to my face, and breathe in the citrus scent. After I do, Heath shows me how to do a fox walk, placing my foot down in a semicircular fashion so I strike the ground with my heel, then my big toe, followed by my little toe. We creep down the path, and he asks me to notice what is moving. I feel more like Elmer Fudd than an observant fox, and I have to quiet my skeptical inner monologue and concentrate on my surroundings. When I do, I notice the ferns bowing and waving. I spot a chipmunk skittering across the path. As we approach the lake, I watch a damselfly skim along the dock. By the time we reach the dock, I realize that having something specific to look for helps me focus and stay present. The sun warms my face as we watch a few kayakers paddle along the small inland lake in Pennsylvania's Poconos, where I've come for a forest bathing lesson. The Japanese practice of Shinrin-yoku works to soak up nature with all the senses, whereas hiking is usually about reaching a destination, and nature walk would take an inquisitive look at plants and animals. Forest therapy encourages participants to engage slowly and deliberately with nature. Guided forest bathing sessions typically include deep breathing exercises, suggestions for aspects of nature to focus on, and invitations to share what you've noticed. This mindful approach to nature has interesting health benefits. Research studies in Japan and Italy have shown forest bathing lowers blood pressure, heart rate, and concentrations of the stress hormone cortisol. It increases sleep duration and boosts the number of natural killer cells, a type of white blood cell that fights infected or tumor cells. There are theories as to why it works, but the science has yet to prove them. In the meantime, The practice continues to spread. Introduced in Japan in the 1980s, it's now a custom here, a common custom, rather, with the government certifying more than 1,700 guides to date. In 2012, wilderness guide Amos Clifford founded the California-based Association of Nature and Forest Therapy, which certifies programs and trains guides. I called Clifford to ask how he discovered forest bathing, and most important, why I need a guide to go play in the great outdoors. He explained that you can do it all on your own, but a guide slows you down and deepens the discipline. Several resorts offer forest bathing, and I traveled to Pennsylvania's Lodge at Woodlock, one of the first resorts in the U.S. to have gone through the Clifford certification. I fight my cynicism and try to approach it with an open mind. That Heath, my guide, isn't straight out of central casting for this role helps. Over 6 feet, with spiky blonde hair that looks like he's growing out of boot camp buzz, the former park ranger admits he didn't think much of forest bathing at first. But he realized that whenever something was gnawing at him, he would go fishing or head into the woods. He found the most forest bathing essentially took the instinct one step further and encouraged more mindfulness. On a small campfire, he heats up a thermos of tea made from local herbs and pours us a cup. Heath, who used to run a skills-building program for middle school kids, says children ask why all the time. Adults don't do that as easily, but nature encourages us to do so, even subtly. I wonder if he realizes he's touching on an idea known as attention restoration therapy, which is one of the arguments for why nature is so healing. At its simplest, the theory says our urban environments are draining because they bombard us with a level of stimulation that requires constant directed attention, responding to emails, navigating traffic, for example. Nature, however, engages our attention in a much more effortless way, and this allows us to restore and reset. While forest bathing is having a moment, and many cultures believe being outside is a balm for mind, body, and spirit, I suspect it's why so many Swiss skip church and head to the mountains on Sundays. It's the idea behind the Norwegian word Frutsalif, which means free air life, but really defies translation, as it's a deeply rooted philosophy that embodies a profound appreciation for nature and a way of living in and with the world. Or part of what the Germans mean with the word, and you'll like this one, Waldesamkeit, which is a feeling of solitude when you're alone in the woods. The next day, I attempt forest bathing on my own. I nestle into the hammock, set the timer on my phone for 15 minutes, and try to settle in. The muscles in my back are tight. I feel like I should be doing something. I close my eyes and watch the intensity of the sunlight shift behind them, and listen to the birds chattering above me. Despite my initial resistance, when the timer goes off, I'm relaxed. That night, I meander back down to the lake, look up, and see the full brilliance of a starry sky unobscured by artificial light. I lie down on the dock, listen to the wind and waves, and I glimpse at a shooting star disappear behind the trees. It's an astonishing natural display, and I fully understand the need to soak it all up. By the way, Kelly DiNardo, you can reach her at Kelly DiNardo on Twitter. She's the author of several books, most recently Living the Sutras, A Guide to Yoga Wisdom Beyond the Mat. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. We hope that you'll listen next time, that you've enjoyed your journey today. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.